Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Hey everyone, Trace here. Joe and I usually take this week off because of the holidays and whatnot, but we actually had an extra episode in the Horror Queers archives that we recorded back in October, and we thought we'd release it as a little holiday treat for all of you. The following episode on Tarsem Singh's The Cell was recorded as part of the Nightstream Film Festival, which, because of COVID-19, was a virtual festival that combined the forces of five different horror fests across the country. This was a virtual broadcast as opposed to an in-person live appearance, but we still had a blast doing it. Also, since this was recorded as a special episode, we don't do our standard housekeeping at the end where we announce which film we're covering next week, so I'll go ahead and do that right now. Next week, Joe and I will be celebrating New Year's in style, and, along with hoping that 2021 is a vast improvement over 2020, we will be covering a film that is directly tied to the holiday. That film is the famed 1980 slasher Terror Train, starring Jamie Lee Curtis. So give that a watch over the weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, and welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Network. The following show is just horrifying. Beware.
Back to Horror Queers. We're talking Albino Ducks, and we're talking Bondage Couture, and we're talking Suspended Masturbation. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace, and we're talking cranky intestine device things.
Oh yeah, yeah. I thought you meant like cranky old men, and I was like, oh, I don't know, this is the wrong movie.
It's a double entendre, because the machine is a crank, but the handler is cranky.
I will allow it. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, we'll do it. Yeah. We're talking Tarsem Singh's The Cell, y'all. And it is, it's a movie celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. And we're so, so, so happy that the Nightstream Film Festival has allowed us to talk about it. Joe, this may be the most popular we've ever been, appearing at five film festivals at once.
Yeah. The thing that we never thought would happen. We got invited to all five. They just only happened to be one this year.
Yeah, so we would like to thank Nightstream Film Festival, which is, of course, made up of the Boston Underground Film Festival, the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival, the North Bend Film Festival, the Overlook Film Festival, and the Popcorn Frights Film Festival. Whew! Thanks, everyone. We're happy to be here in our own home.
Yeah. And, of course, for those of you who maybe don't know what Horror Queers is, A, thanks for clicking play on this. We are an LGBTQ podcast that looks at horror films through a queer lens, and we're part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network. Hence the tits.
Tits up.
Yeah. Tits up.
Yeah. So, you know, we have decided to discuss The Cell, well, because, again, it was an opportunity for its anniversary, but also because it's something that both of us, I'm pretty sure, really, really like and haven't, well, I haven't revisited it in a bit. What about you, Joe?
No, when I went back to rewatch this for this, I realized I think it's been at least a decade, maybe 15 years.
It's 100% one that I saw in college, and I really enjoyed it then, but I think it's definitely a film that was maybe, I don't know if it was misunderstood or just underappreciated upon its release. But it's definitely one that I've seen more and more people lately kind of come into the fold and be like, oh, The Cell's actually a really good movie. And it's like, yeah, no shit. Awesome.
Well, and I wonder if part of the reason that people didn't love it is that it was coming, I mean, this is a 2000 film, but it's really like a late 90s film in a lot of ways. And I wonder if it's because people at this point were just sick and tired of serial killer police procedural films.
That very well may be the case. I mean, you know, I'm fully aware of this film's flaws because it has quite a few. One of them is that the narrative is very just standard police procedural with an added sci-fi twist. Yeah. But, you know, post Silence of the Lambs, post Seven, post Copycat, like, it doesn't, CSI probably actually existed by this point. Maybe, I'm not really sure.
Yeah. If not, it was on the horizon.
Law and Order definitely did.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, maybe it was just something that people weren't ready for. Of course, you have the accusations of the film being a lot of style over substance, and I won't disagree with that.
I also don't think that that's a flaw. Like,
I don't either. Like, I mean, there have been plenty of films that I've seen that are style over substance, but, like, the style isn't enough, or yeah, it comes across as quite masturbatory on the filmmaker's part.
Right.
That I don't really get I don't get that feeling from Singh in this movie.
No, and this feels like a big homecoming for him. If you think about the fact that he got his start as a music video director, you can see all of that style percolating, and we're going to talk a lot about the references and the, I guess, where he's drawing influence from in this. But I think at the end of the day, this also feels like somebody's first big kick at the can, and he really wanted to showcase what he was capable of delivering. I would actually argue that the better Tarsem Singh movie is The Fall, which is the film that he made after this, which kind of blends both narrative and stylistic influences. But as a first go, I mean, I think he's playing within the genre tropes that people come to expect, but he's doing it with such visual flair. It's hard not to regard this as a modern classic.
I fully agree. And I mean, again, besides the style over substance, you know, you had people, and because I haven't seen The Fall. It's one that I always saw the case for in Blockbuster because it's such a distinctively designed film case. Mm-hmm. And do you know if he wrote that as well, or did he just direct it?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if he did, if only because it feels very him.
Well, because one of the things, and I always laugh when people, like, they put it all on the director, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but Tarsem Singh, like, if you want to accuse the film of being style over substance, that's totally fine. But the substance is from the script and the performances. Right. He didn't write this script.
He did not. This script
is written by Mark Protosevich. We're going to say Protosevich.
Okay.
Now, granted, this man has disowned this movie. This is his first feature screenwriting credit. He basically said that the film barely resembles his original script, which went under several rewrites from uncredited screenwriters and the executives at Warner Brothers and New Line. So he wasn't proud of the final result.
Right.
And he actually wants the film to get a remake. And to that I say, no.
No. Sorry. Just to backtrack quickly, Tarsem Singh is one of three screenwriters on The Fall, along with Nico Soltanakis, don't know, and Dan Gilroy.
Should I know Dan Gilroy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Also known as the writer of Nightcrawler and your favorite film, Velvet Buzzsaw.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I really want to see The Fall now. But, okay, well, so going back to Mr. Protosevich over here, it might shock you to know that because when I saw his filmography, I was like, okay, because I think you and I talked about this offline, that the characters in this film are, for the most part, not super fleshed out. I wouldn't go as far to say they're one-dimensional. Like, there's a little bit more to them than that, but this is definitely, again, it's more about the visuals than it is about the interior. Well, I was going to say the interior lives of these characters.
The literal interior lives.
But I was like, okay, well, let's look at what this guy's done. The film he did after this is the 2006 remake of The Poseidon Adventure, which also has paper-thin characters that are fucking terrible. So he also ended up writing I Am Legend, the Will Smith movie, and that's not really one that I particularly care for.
I fucking hate it.
And then he also wrote the screenplay for Spike Lee's remake of Old Boy. Those are his big credits.
Those are not great credits.
I would argue that the Old Boy remake is his best. I don't hate the remake. It's just, it's very much an example of, like, why are you doing this? Because right, there's just not much that's different about it. But again, when you watch it, you're like, well, this isn't really his screenplay. Like, this is definitely the original screenwriter's work that he just adapted a little bit.
Yeah. Made it a smidge American, right?
But it just makes me laugh, you know, because this is a movie that, like, I guess maybe it's, like, from a writing standpoint, it's not the same. We'll never know because we don't have the original script in our hands.
Right.
But as a final product, I think it's a fantastic film. And it's definitely one that the box office was, you know, pretty much... Well, hey, let's just dive into that.
Do it.
The Cell is released on August 18th of the year 2000. The year of our Lord, 2000. And it is released by New Line Cinema. We've got a runtime of 107 minutes, unless You are watching the Blu-ray, which came out 5 years ago, which is the quote-unquote director's cut. It is about 2 minutes longer, and basically what's longer about it is the suspended masturbation scene. And I was really upset because I have the DVD.
Oh no, you haven't seen the wank. Okay.
No, it was basically where he suspends himself on his piercings and, you know, masturbates over the corpse, and we'll talk about that in more detail as we get to that scene. But they had snipped some of it for fear of getting an NC-17 rating. Weirdly enough, it didn't get the NC-17 rating, and then they had to cut it. They just cut it for fear of being branded initially an NC-17 rating.
Right. I mean, we've heard of this before, right? Where you shoot for more gore, more sexual violence, and so on, and then you say, okay, well, now we've got content to cut. But then every once in a while, the MPAA falls down on their fucking conservative jobs, and they don't ask for the cuts. And I'm always confused when productions still make the cut as a result. You're like, just keep it in there. You got away with it.
I mean, it even goes back to like doing, I think it was Scream 2, right? Where they intentionally filmed scenes that were gorier. So they would like, because without the intention of using the gorier scenes, that way when the MPAA gave them the NC-17, they could cut it down to get an R, which is with the footage they were originally going to use.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it wasn't until 2015 that this extra cut was available. So I didn't get to watch this version. Did you?
I mean, I definitely saw him furiously masturbating, so I'm going to assume yes.
Well, no, that scene is in my cut, but it's just longer in the director's cut, so I don't know.
Hmm. How would I know about a longer masturbation scene?
I tried to find clips, and I couldn't find it.
Aww.
But this film was given a budget of $33 million, and like you said, this is Tarsem Singh's feature directorial debut. He mostly came from the world of music videos, and that's not a surprise given the look of the film.
Yeah.
And we've discussed this before, but it's always kind of a crapshoot whenever you have someone that moves from music videos to feature film, and there's a lot of inspiration from that here, from be it his own music videos, but also a lot of others as well, and we'll go into those. But I just wonder if maybe that was something that critics were holding against it at the time.
Yeah, I think even nowadays, whenever you see people like, oh, well, they got their start in music videos, there's a weird predisposition to saying, well, it's going to be all style over substance, or this person's not going to be able to handle a narrative. And there's a weird judginess considering some of the more high profile directors that actually got their start in music videos. Like, shockingly enough, we're quick to judge as a society, and we don't always love our music video directors.
Yeah. So basically the cell opens, and it opens at the number one spot with $17.5 million. So
I was there opening weekend.
I was 11 opening weekend, so I was not seeing this movie in theaters. Could you imagine though?
I would argue it's actually not that bad. There's like a couple of things that are very disturbing for kids, but
I mean, I think the masturbation scene takes place 15 minutes into this movie. I think that's pretty like,
oh, is that the litmus test?
I think that's a litmus test. Yeah, it goes on to gross $61.3 million domestically with a worldwide total of with an international gross of $42.8 million for a worldwide total of $104 million.
Not bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost three times its budget, which I think is pretty much like the metric for people to say a film is successful, is when it earns three times its budget. Hmm. So it's fine. Unfortunately, Singh hasn't really gone on to match the success, at least financially, of this film. Because I think The Fall had a pretty,
it was disastrous. I don't even know if it got a wide release, to be honest.
I don't think it did. And it was one of those ones, I didn't know it was him. And when I saw the case in Blockbuster, I was just like, oh, that's just like some weird art film, which, you know, I'm sure it is.
It kind of is. Yeah.
But yeah, and then he would go on to do, I think it's 2011's Immortals, which I have not seen, but I've heard is hot garbage.
Oh, there's your example of style over substance, because that movie is shit. But it looks amazing.
I mean, because it came out like post 300, and so I wonder if that was just kind of the vibe that everyone was going for with that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, picture the costumes and the styling of this, only with like shitty 300.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His last notable film was Mirror, Mirror, the Snow White movie with Julia Roberts, which I actually enjoy. I like it. It's real stupid, but it's really funny. And then
it's
he did
a very
some
different
random
audience, too, so.
Yeah, it's totally a kid's movie. Imagine The Cell, but for kids, and with Julia Roberts.
A movie you could have seen at 11.
But yeah, he hasn't really done much since. He did a Ryan Reynolds movie called Selfless, and lately he's been doing Lady Gaga music videos with the recent video for 911. So there's that. It's high profile.
I mean, yeah, like, let's be honest, there's probably more people watching a Lady Gaga music video than there was, like, The Fall.
I think more people watched that video on opening day than more people saw The Fall in its entire first year of release.
Right. So, in that case, maybe I should be less quick to judge, because he's probably doing pretty well.
I don't have much left to say regarding the production, other than, I mean, the costume design here. He hired Eiko Ishioka, who actually worked on Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Coppola film. And you'll see that a lot in the muscle outfits, like, that they have to wear. Mm-hmm. And then when we're talking about comparisons to Silence of the Lambs, honestly, I mean, besides the narrative, they have the same composer. Howard Shore does the score for this film just like he did the score for Silence of the Lambs. And so I wonder, like, watching that today as I was cognizant of that fact, I was kind of like, there's parts with the FBI raid and right. the helicopter shots where the score is highly reminiscent of the score from Silence of the Lambs. But overall, it's very much its own thing.
I mean, here's the thing. So we talked about Copycat for the Salem Horror Fest last week, and if we're being honest, I think there's not a huge amount of creativity in the types of crime procedurals that are coming out at this time. So basically within about a 10-year span, like throughout most of the 90s, a lot of these films were kind of telling the same story. So it's not surprising to me that certain scores, certain sequences, like, they all just seem to speak to one another. Or in the case of things like Copycat and The Cell, people just say, oh, well, you're doing a shittier version of Silence of the Lambs. It's whoever got the highest profile, which in this case was the Oscar winner who made Bank, mm-hmm. is then, like, the top dog, and everybody just gets compared, and nobody comes out looking good. But I think we also, as I said then, I think it's a disservice to films if we just constantly say, like, oh, well, this movie is just, like, a shittier, more stylistic version of Silence of the Lambs. Like, well, it's probably not trying to be Silence of the Lambs.
No, I mean, I think that I'm sure that, oh my god, with Protasevich, that's going to take me forever to memorize. I'm sure he maybe, like, worked on that as a base, like, a base idea. But, I mean, again, the police procedural is not, like, Silence of the Lambs didn't invent that.
No. And, like, it'd be great if people maybe stopped giving it all the fucking credit for being a crime film.
I mean, there is a ticking clock aspect here. You do have a villain that is, I hesitate to call him queer, but there's moments, you know, with his father calling him some gay slurs and his propensity for playing with dolls as a child and doing housework and ironing stuff and blah, blah, blah. I don't know if the film is trying to do a shorthand way of saying, oh, this man it's a gay man who has been abused, and that's why he is the way he is, and we can talk about that as we get into those scenes.
Yeah.
But that aspect does call to mind a bit of the problematic aspect of Silence of the Lambs with the Buffalo Bill killer, but I still don't, it's not so focused on that to where I'm like, that's what it is. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. If nothing else, this film seems far less interested in really unpacking that. I have seen some people talk about how they don't love that this film makes excuses or apologize for Carl Starger's criminal behavior by suggesting, like, oh, well, we should feel sorry for him or feel empathy because he was abused as a child. And mm-hmm. I think that that's a bit of a shorthand way of reading this. If anything, I would say the films suggest that people are never just one thing. Like, they have multiple facets to their personalities, and sometimes they battle. And, like, there's an explicit reference of schizophrenia in here, which suggests that he's got multiple competing identities, and one of them is a king, and one of them is a child.
Well, and, I mean, the film does bring up other, like, alternative viewpoints, where someone's like, well, other people have been abused as well, and they don't turn into, like, killers like this. I think maybe with the way the film ends, maybe that's where the people are like, oh, the film is arguing that it's okay, and I don't really necessarily subscribe to that, or that the film is doing that, but, you know, your mileage may vary.
Different readings for different folks.
But yeah, so that's really all I have to say. Do you want to kick us off with a plot summary?
Absolutely. And for those of you who have never joined us before, the plot summary will be the remainder of the episode.
Yes. We will be commentating. Sure, that's a word. Yeah, on the plot summary. For the rest of the episode.
Okay, so we open with Catherine Dean, played by the one and only J-Lo, Jenny from the Block herself. And she is
dressed... All right, wait.
Okay.
Let's just get this
You want to get this over with right off the top?
I love Jennifer Lopez, and people shit on her all the time, much, because really after this movie, I think 2001 is when she did The Wedding Planner, and that's when she kind of entered her rom-com phase. Mm-hmm. But even before then, I mean, like, what? We're looking at Anaconda. We're looking at Selena. We're looking at Out of Sight. Mm-hmm. People constantly underestimate her. And I'm not going to speak to how she is as a person, because there's a lot of rumors that she's, like, secretly a bitch or whatever.
She's a bit of a diva.
Which, you know what? So is Mariah Carey, and people don't give her shit. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe they do.
You know what? Here's the thing. If you're this kind of global superstar, maybe you're also allowed to be a bit of a diva. It's what we do as a culture.
I think that's fair. But also, people tend to not like her as an actress. And I feel like this is the film, at least in the horror community, we love Anaconda, but people don't go to Anaconda and say, oh, she gives like a fantastic performance in that movie. And I'd argue she's fine in this movie. She's working with not a lot of character. But she is an actress who I think is able to elevate mediocre material to like, or even terrible material, to watchable. Now, granted, if you want, like, a five-star film from her, go watch Out of Sight. She's fantastic in that.
Or Hustlers.
You can watch something shitty, like, oh god, The Backup Plan, which is a shitty movie. But she's so charismatic that it just makes it borderline watchable. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very much the thing. This is maybe her least successful outing as an actress, if only because she doesn't have something really powerful to work with. Like, she's constantly being upstaged by the visuals, and I would even add D'Onofrio, because he gets all the fun kind of showy stuff to do. But like, it's not like she is a detraction from this film either. Like, she's doing what she needs to do. She's highly watchable. She doesn't give a bad performance. It's just not like a super super exciting performance. But I would also argue that's who the character is. Like, she's a child psychologist. She's just there to try to help this kid. Like,
yeah.
What are people expecting?
So basically, if you're watching this and you're like, man, I really like the cell, but I fucking hate J-Lo, leave.
Yeah, just get the fuck out now.
All right, sorry. I do that out of the way. Go ahead.
Good. So we are introduced to her. This is all silent. So she is riding a black horse. She's wearing this feathery white gown across the desert. This is shot in Africa and it looks fucking gorgeous. It's absolutely stunning.
You're let into like what kind of a movie you're about to watch, like almost right off the bat.
Yeah, and I would argue that this opening scene is quite smart, because not only does it tell you, okay, you can expect amazing visuals and kind of weird, uncanny, surreal dream logic, but also it's like, hey, this is what this machine can do at this Campbell Institute. So it's like, here's your primer, and then we'll get into the crime procedural shit in a little bit. Just bear with us.
Right.
Okay, so with all that said, you know, she meets a boy, she tries to help him, he turns into a little bit of a monster and runs away, and she gets fed up and she exits out of this kind of VR simulation program.
Maki-lock. I wish that the boogeyman would have taken on, like, a more actual physical appearance as opposed to just, like, morphing the boy's face.
Do you want a Babadook?
Sure.
So at this point, we are introduced to our doctor characters. This is Dr. Miriam, played by Marion Jean-Baptiste, as well as Dr. Barry, played by Dylan Baker, in a non-scary, threatening, weird role. It's very odd to see him this way.
Well, because like, when was Happiness? Happiness was like 95, 96 when he's playing the pedophile.
Gosh, maybe. And then we would have had Trick or Treat in and around this time period where he's playing a serial killer.
Well, that would have been like 7 years later, but sure.
No, Trick or Treat is like...
2007.
Fuck, is it really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Time is a flat circle.
It's the beauty of a video, y'all, of live conferencing. We can't actually look this shit up. So anyway.
Yeah, so basically at this point we find out that they're working in this center that is doing these experimental kind of comatose VR simulation treatments. And Catherine is a child therapist, and she's been working with this child that we saw in the dream. He is comatose. He's got billionaire parents who are funding this whole project. They're played by Patrick Bauchau. Probably got that wrong. But and also Masetta Vander. Did you recognize her?
I did, but wait. So I recognize her as Sindel from Mortal Kombat Annihilate. Okay, good.
Correct. Gay.
I saw her face and I was like, she kind of, because she reminded me of the wife and Mr. Robot.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Because she has like really like just like striking features, and so I looked her up and I was like, oh, it's Sindel from that shitty movie.
Yeah, not the good Mortal Kombat, folks. The bad Mortal Kombat. She gets two lines in this movie. I mean, basically, these parents are here to be like, we're going to take our funding and our sick, comatose child because you have delivered zero results in 16 months or 18 months. Yep. And she's like, ooh, they don't like me. I'm a failure. Maybe I should practice my skills on this comatose serial killer guy.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, though. So the boy is comatose, though, because he also has the same type of schizophrenia that the killer has.
Oh, I did not catch that part. But if what a coinky dink.
I thought that too. And I was like, oh, that's really coincidental that they happen to get a killer that has the same fucking problem.
In the same geographical proximity. Because it all happens in one day, folks. They've only got until the end of the day until that tank fills up with water.
Maybe that was Protasevich. He was like, they just really like streamline my entire complex screenplay. I'm disowning it.
In my screenplay, it was 2 days, not one. Yeah. Okay, so we also have our introduction to Carl Starker, who is played by Vincent D'Onofrio. He's got an absolutely atrocious 2000s haircut.
It's a wig.
Is it a wig? Okay.
It is a wig.
Full-on described it as a bob in my notes. I mean, you can kind of tell because he's bald as King Starker, and that was pretty natural.
So my only point of reference for Vincent D'Onofrio at the time this would have come out would have been Men in Black. He's the bug. He's like the creepy bug with the human skin suit. And that's it. Like, that's it. So I just know him as playing creeps.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what my point of reference would have been. Obviously, he's like Vincent fucking D'Onofrio. He's had a storied career. He's gone on to do tons of things, but it's weird. I don't know if you ever get this when you watch films that you don't think they're that old. Like, this movie doesn't feel 20 years old to me, and that's partially just because, you know, you get to a certain age and time doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. But
yeah.
I 100% was like, oh, he's young and fit in this movie, and I'm kind of used to seeing like older, plumper, jollier Vincent D'Onofrio.
He also doesn't get a ton of dialogue in this movie, but I would argue his performance informs enough of what we need to know about this crazy, crazy person.
Yeah, he's quite captivating, I would argue, in both of his roles, like even when he's just playing a regular human being, quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And then obviously everything to do in this dreamscape is fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
So he arrives at this deserted shack in the middle of the desert, and he's got his albino dog, Valentine, with him. Very cute. And he is greeted by the sight of a dead woman who is suspended in a tank filled with water.
So, okay, this is a really funny story that I kind of love. So apparently, like, this woman, like, she... No, I know.
I was like, where is this going?
This corpse. No, so apparently, like, this woman, like, someone had to audition to be this corpse. Like, absolutely. Like, she's, like, really be really comfortable with water. Right. She's great at doing it. Mm-hmm. The woman who ends up being captured, who is, like, in the cell for the whole movie, he asked her, like, oh, are you comfortable being underwater? Can you swim? And she was like, yeah, I'm great. I'm a lifeguard. But she couldn't be underwater without holding her nose at all.
Right.
And it really pissed him off. Tarsem Singh, by him, I mean, not Vincent D'Onofrio. And Singh takes, like, no less than 3 jabs at her in the commentary of this film. And then in a deleted scene, which is one of hers, she goes, oh yeah, I had no reservations about cutting anything with this woman. Like,
wow.
Because he said, like, oh, like, you know, you'll say, oh, can you ride a horse? And they'll say yes, that's just what actors do, and they'll just go learn to ride a horse. But don't say you're a jockey, and, like, so don't be like, oh, I was a lifeguard, I'm an expert swimmer, and then have to hold your nose like this when you're swimming underwater.
Yeah, that is a little bit strange, and particularly because, like, one would argue, like, if you know how to swim, if you know how to hold your breath, it's Not the hardest of skills. Like, I would argue learning to horseback ride would be way harder and way more of an ask. So
then just the whole, yeah. So that's why we don't actually get a lot of footage of her in this film, because he just didn't want to shoot it.
You know what? I'm kind of fine with it. The taste that we get of her, it's doing what it needs to do. But I also don't need to see, like, long sustained takes of this woman suffering and crying. Like, I got it. I can move on. To be honest, like, every moment that's spent in the real world in this movie, I'm like, less of this, more of the dream stuff.
I actually clocked it. So everything that's in the mind, it takes up barely, just barely over a third of the movie's runtime.
Really?
Really. It's about 100, it's an hour and 42 minutes without credits at the end. And it's about like 35. Nope, it's not. Whatever. It's about 35% of the runtime is the mind stuff. And it's fascinating, though, which also kind of goes to show, though, how little impression the non-mind scenes make, as opposed to the ones that take place in the mind of the killer.
Yeah. Oh, there's full-on, like, a sustained conversation between J-Lo and Vince Vaughn, and I just got up and went to the bathroom and came back and realized, oh, I should have paused it. And then I was like, meh.
Oh, well, we'll see which conversation that was, because it might have been the important one.
Oh, it's probably the important one. Yeah. Okay, so we cut back to Catherine at this Campbell Institute, and she is arguing that the reason that they haven't found success with this child is because she always has to go into his mind. So she proposes this experimental, unorthodox procedure, and the other two are like, a fuck no. This is, like, way too risky, and also, you're kind of new at this, so maybe take it down a notch. And these early scenes are really kind of character-based. Like, it's to get the sense that she's young. She's a little bit impulsive. She wants to prove herself. She doesn't have, like, a very substantial home life. Like, we see her at her apartment. She's just hanging out, like, watching TV, kind of eating microwavable meals.
So this scene is actually replicated in The Wedding Planner, when she's, like, this, like, fancy wedding planner, and she goes home and she just has her perfect frozen dinner that she eats on a TV tray. Like all these J-Lo rom-coms have, like, what is her normal life at home like? And I just love that The Cell has that, too.
I also love that they probably had to sit J-Lo down and be like, so this is what a normal person does. Like, there's no pink toilet paper and there's no butlers, and the apartment that you live in will be the size of two people shoulder to shoulder. And J-Lo's just like, no, I don't get it. How does this work? Like, where's the bell that I ring to have food delivered?
Exactly.
So these scenes are all kind of like, hey, this is Catherine. You should care about her. She's got a waterbed, so she's similar to the killer.
Okay. Water's a big motif in this movie. I also love when they're explaining his schizophrenia that Pruitt Taylor Vince is like, oh yeah, sometimes the trigger can be water-based. Like, it's usually water-based. Okay.
Yeah, that's also the title of my sex tape, but no need to go there.
Water-based!
So, these scenes are intercut with Carl doing his at-home routine, which is dressing bodies, you know, washing them in bleach, sterilizing them, and then suspending himself in the air so that he can watch footage of this woman dying and masturbating over her corpse.
I know I said at the beginning that, like, you know, the opening, like, lets you know the movie you're in for right away. This scene is probably the one that does that the most.
I don't understand. Why would you say that?
It's a bold choice to have this scene 15 minutes into your film.
Yeah.
I've never experienced suspension before, and I can't really speak for the portrayal of it. I mean, it is accurate, like, based on just the image of it. But okay. I do wonder how the BDSM community feels about seeing it portrayed, like, again, with a killer, as opposed to, like, because it has more of in the BDSM world, it's used to create a heightened sense of vulnerability and inescapability, okay. Because you just have this feeling of weightlessness. But then for some people, it can be like, it can be objectifying, or, you know, give you a sense of submissiveness or erotic helplessness, which is good. Or even people do it as performance art in fetish themed nightclubs.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating that it's used in this way, because it adds the sexual element to it. Now, you, of course, it can be that, but it's not necessarily a requirement. So that we do get this shot of him masturbating over the bleached doll-like corpse of his previous victim. I think it's a cool MO, like in terms of serial killers in film goes, like it's really memorable. But it's also like, whew, I don't know.
Yeah, I can definitely see people taking issue with this, if only because it immediately codifies him as, oh, okay, well, if you didn't think he was a bad guy, he's also a weirdo sexually. So there's very much, there's a judgy tone to it, I find.
Mm-hmm. Like stigmatizing the fetish, right?
Exactly. So I imagine if you were someone who was stepping outside of the, you know, norm in terms of your sexual practice and you weren't super vanilla, you might look at this and be like, oh, so I'm basically on the sliding scale towards deviancy and murdering women and treating them like dolls, according to this movie. So I can understand why people would take offense.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, otherwise, as a casual viewer, it's shocking.
Yeah. I fully didn't remember this. I remembered that he had the rings in his back, but I didn't remember him masturbating. It was kind of like, oh, okay.
We're also leaving out the fact that he's watching the video footage of her drowning and crying for help. So it's like the combination of like him having like him literally being over the corpse of his victim, who is made to look like a doll with the bleached skin and everything, while also like still being able to hear her suffer. So there's an added component to that. So it may even just be that it's more the suffering that he's getting off onto than the actual act of suspension. But yeah, we'll never know.
We won't know. You could make the argument one way or the other, or both. Mm-hmm. Why not both? So, after the scene, the body is discovered by FBI agents Peter Novak, who is played by Vince Vaughn, as well as his partner, Gordon Ramsay, your friend, Jake Weber. And it's also fun that they've got character actor Dean Norris from Breaking Bad, long before Breaking Bad was ever a thing.
Totally forgot. Also, my Jake Weber, I only know him from Medium because I actually watched Medium.
Yeah, you and grandmothers across the country watched Medium, Trace. That's why he is yours.
Starring future Oscar winner Patricia Arquette, okay? I don't know what to tell you.
I can't remember. It was one episode, but I definitely confused Medium with Ghost Whisperer, didn't I?
Yes, 100%. And same concept, similar concept, different networks. NBC for one, CBS for the other.
Yes. And both surprisingly successful.
Yeah. Yeah, they went on for a long time.
All this to say, I do actually also enjoy Jake Weber. He's the kind of person where I don't know that he pops on screen. He definitely looks like he should be playing somebody's husband every time you see him. But I don't know. He's a welcome familiar face in this movie. Like this film is kind of filled with character actors and then also Vince Vaughn, but like in a tolerable sense.
But my thing is, Vince Vaughn is fine in this movie. I mean, this is like 2 years after he did Psycho. I don't think you need two cops. I think that you could have gotten rid of the Jake Weber character, but okay.
Yeah. Even the moment late in the film where they call up this Cole character and they're like, go in the basement, look for the insignia. You're like, we don't need that. We've already made the visual connection.
Yeah, there's no point. But whatever.
There's so many men in this movie.
I mean, if he got killed later in the film, maybe I would get it, you know, like Jeff Daniels in Speed. But we don't get that. He's just alive.
Yeah. Let's be honest, like pretty much nobody dies in this movie. There's like a woman who's already dead, and then Vincent Tenavri at the end. That's it.
Yeah. And and the end one is a mercy kill, so.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so they find the body, and these scenes are now intercut with them sort of like trying to capture his MO, and then we also see Carl, he's already on the prowl, so his MO is also that he is escalating as a serial killer. So he's looking at his next victim, Julia Hickson, who is played by Tara Subkoff, she of the lifeguard who can't swim.
I like the setup, though. I mean, the way he's got this dog set to just, like, act dead, perfect.
Yeah, as somebody who doesn't own a dog and has never owned a dog, I was like, can you really train a dog to look like it's been run over and make the whiny noises? That's alarming. Dogs used for bad purposes makes me uncomfortable.
But again, that's reminiscent. I mean, again, we're going back to Silence of the Lambs. It's reminiscent of the scene when Brooke Smith gets captured in the van. So
very much so. You know what? This is Silence of the Lambs. Let's just own it.
It's fine.
Yeah, so he abducts her, and the FBI almost immediately zeroes in on him. It's kind of funny just how quickly they manage to catch him, considering how alarmed they are that his MO is that he's escalating. It's like, eh, well, you got him in the next scene. So they end up breaking into his house because they have tracked him by his albino dog hair. So, you know, burgeoning serial killers, go for a generic dog. Try not to get a really unusual dog. It's going to get you caught faster.
3 years ago, he bought an albino German Shepherd from this breeder, and we found her, and we got his name. But I think this is a really good subversion of the trope, though, because, yeah, they find him, like, in the first act of this movie. It's great.
Yeah, it's not what you would expect at all.
Right.
But, of course, before they can actually get him, he is in the bath, he has a traumatic trigger, and he tries to use his pills, which we never really find out what they are, but they're probably some kind of, like, anti-hysteric or calming sedative, I don't know. And he doesn't have any. He's fresh out of pills, so he ends up collapsing, and they discover his comatose body, much like the boy from the opening scene. So they get a diagnosis from Dr. Reed, as you said, Pruitt Taylor Vince. I did love that Tarsen Singh apparently cast Taylor Vince because of his iconic, like, twitching eye feature, and then the studio was like, no, it's distracting and funny, get rid of him.
There were a lot of studio notes for this film, also with test audiences, I think, and we'll talk about that a bit more when we get into Catherine's backstory, because they changed a major aspect of that for the film.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe for the best, we'll see.
We'll see. I disagree.
We'll get that. So Dr. Reed, you know, more or less gives them the exposition of this is what this guy has. It's a rare form of Alzheimer's where he is now comatose. He will likely never wake up. So you fucked. This woman is going to die in this automated cell, which will fill with water in 24 hours. Stop the clock.
Yeah. How do they know the timeline? Is there an explanation for that?
I think they figured out how long she had been submerged in the water, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then oh, okay, this is how long she was taken before she then turned up dead.
Yeah, because they keep mentioning how the timeline between the body discoveries and capturing the woman, the disappearance, is like keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
And they're really dead set on thinking that he really wants to be caught.
Yeah. And of course, we don't get any of that because we don't really know anything about Carl. He says nothing, and then he goes into a comatose state.
Yep.
Yeah. So they say, okay, what the fuck are we going to do? Because if not, this lady is screwed. And Dr. Reed is the one who helpfully says, oh, well, you should reach out to this Campbell Center. They've only got this one billionaire patient, so you could probably ask them to do your dirty work in a 12-hour period. And off we go.
There we go.
There we go. Super convenient. So they make a presentation. They basically guilt trip J-Lo into doing this. Well,
no, so Dylan Baker is like, oh yeah, do it, not my body. And then Marion Jean Baptiste is like, I think we should, it's really up to her.
Let's maybe not speak for women's bodies, Dylan Baker, you fucking asshole.
Catherine's like, well, I mean, like, it's not really possible, but is it possible? I mean, I guess anything's possible. Okay, cool, let's do it.
Yeah, like, I'm not, I do like that she kind of says, so he's like a serial killer, right? Do you think he would have given you the information? Because why do you think me, a vulnerable, young, very attractive woman, is going to be able to appeal to the serial killer? Like, I was kind of surprised that Vince Vaughn's character, Peter, doesn't go, maybe we should bleach your hair before we send you in, since he seems to like women.
Like that? Her hair. Oh my god, can you imagine?
I mean, it doesn't really matter. We're meant to believe that she doesn't have control over how she looks when she goes into the dream state anyway. It's all Carl who kind of dresses her based on what he wants her to be in that given moment.
See, I mean, again, so we enter the dream now. I'm hesitant to call it a dream. And I think Singh was too. Like, it's so easy to call it that. But they were, because dream logic is something that they were trying to avoid, I think, narratively. And so I don't know. It's the mind or whatever, but it's 40 minutes into the film. So what we have just described is the first 40 minutes. There's an hour left of this movie.
And we will talk for the full hour. Yeah, I think I call it either dream or subconscious, because really, like, she's going into his mind and he's not conscious. So, like, unconscious, subconscious, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, you can draw comparisons to the movie Dreamscape. I mean, because it's more horror-based, I was totally going for Nightmare on Elm Street this entire time, especially with some of the tropes we'll see later.
That's good, yeah. I mean, I think whenever you have people go into a dream, it's like, all right, which of the three films are you going to maybe reference or try to avoid referencing?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is surprising, because it's such a fertile place to go, narratively and visually, right?
I mean, I would argue that The Cell is a better Nightmare on Elm Street sequel than some of the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels.
Oh my. Yeah, not going to disagree with that. We'll talk offline which ones you think it is better than.
We'll see who's cursing me out right now.
Right, yeah. Freddy's dead. Oh,
I love that one.
So immediately the whatever you want to call it, the dream logic, the crazy heightened visual kicks in.
Well, and we immediately are taken to a baptism. And I don't know about you, but this resonated with me a lot. And this is kind of where I'm going. Oh, well, this is kind of where I'm going, though, with the queer story. I mean, I don't know if I read Stargirl as queer. I don't know if I do. But given what seems to be either like a Pentecostal type religious background with him and his family, like, it just seems like, you know, growing up super Catholic, I was just kind of like, oh, like this, like, I mean, it was not that. It was not the Pentecostal stuff. And when I was baptized, it was a baby. I was a baby and it was like not being drowned.
Right. So you weren't in the woods. You weren't wearing like old timey clothes.
Right. And granted, it can also be kind of seen as like just kind of surface level. Oh, well, he had a really bad religious upbringing, which led to abuse. And that's why he's insane.
Yep.
And that is what it is. The film doesn't seem interested in diving further into that.
No.
Other than just saying that's what it is.
Yeah.
But as someone who just did have kind of a slightly stricter religious background, if not quite as strict as what this film is portraying, I felt a bit more empathetic towards him. But again, like, is that a problem? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting because had it just been this scene and we were just left to believe that it was a religious thing, then I think it would be a very different interpretation. But then we get added physical abuse that is almost sexualized, right? So I kind of looked at this as, oh, the triggering point is that he had this negative experience, but really it's all tying back to the abuse he suffers at the hands of his father, which maybe doesn't have a religious connotation at all. But because we see them linked in this film, we kind of end up having to put them together.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so we get this baptism, it then becomes inverted, so we're seeing it upside down, and then Catherine wakes up, she's in a damp sewer, and we get blood droplets that are falling in slow motion.
A lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a lot of music videos at this time, like I grew up on, we called it Much Video. It's basically what MTV was, only here in Canada, we called it
Much Video. Oh, okay. I thought it was like an era of music that I missed out.
No. But this was the era for music videos. Like, people were spending tons of money to promote songs and singles in video form. So, like, every Friday, I would come home, because I was a loser, I would sit down and I would watch, like, video countdowns, like, the top 20 videos of the week according to the charts. So you would watch all the music videos. So, like, I vividly remember several of the music videos that Sing is paying homage to or is drawing influence from, like the Marilyn Manson video for it's not The Dope Show, it's Beautiful People.
So the main Marilyn Manson ones are the ones that were directed by Floria Sigismondi, and that is for Tourniquet and The Beautiful People.
Right. Yeah, I vividly remember seeing the video for The Beautiful People all the time, because not only was it a massive song, but that video ended up becoming iconic as a result. Interestingly enough, that director has since become a feature filmmaker. She's the one who directed The Turning from earlier this year.
Oh!
Which got accusations of style over substance.
Yeah, well, because there was no substance, because there was no third act in that movie.
Yeah, it has some problems with studio interference.
Yes, 100%. So, yeah, but we get this first, this immediate setting as she sees the young Carl Starger. This image of, like, the staircase on the opposite sides of the room, that is H.R. Giger. There's a portrait or a painting he did called Schacht, which I would say Swedish for something.
We did our research.
I think it's Schacht. It's Swedish for shaft. But it looks just like the stairs in the empty room.
Yeah, I'll confess I got a little bit of like M.C. Escher, Leviathan from Hellraiser 2 as well, which is entirely possibly driven by things like Geiger as well.
And now that we're talking Nightmare on Elm Street sequels, the fifth Nightmare on Elm Street movie, Dream Child, does have a whole scene. Or actually, maybe it's New Nightmare, when it's like Nancy running upside down some stairs and stuff.
Oh,
it's
either that,
or it's the fifth one. Yeah,
I think it's New Nightmare.
Yeah, I think it is too.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Because all of these images are so striking, right? Like, particularly because they're the kind of thing that you just can't see in real life, or you will never see in real life. So it immediately conveys to you that you are in the realm of the fantastic. And I think it prepares you for some of the visual sights that we'll see where we say, oh, okay, the danger is real.
Right.
You have to be prepared for the unexpected. Because right after the scene is where we get the horse, which to me, it's the most iconic scene in the entire movie.
It is. It's gorgeous. I mean, even though once the horse is split, the CGI clearly kicks in and it's still beating and like the ears are twitching. Like, it's great. That, of course, is a reference to it's the works of British artist Damien Hirst. And there's it's basically one of his exhibits. It's not like a painting, but it exhibits that were like looked like the split horse. And of course, that was emulated later in Brian Fuller's Hannibal TV series.
Yeah, which I would argue is actually one of its most striking visual images from the first season as well.
Oh, 100%. I just wanted to ask, though, do you know who's playing young Carl Starger?
I have his name. It is Jake Thomas. Is that kid from Star Wars?
No, he might be from Star Wars, I don't know. Oh, but no, so that's Jake Lloyd.
There we go.
Jake Thomas is mostly known for playing Matt McGuire on The Lizzie McGuire Show.
Nope.
Also, The Lizzie McGuire movie. He's Lizzie's younger brother.
So people who are new to the podcast, this is a way that Trace trolls me. As regularly as possible, he somehow manages to find a way to bring the fucking Lizzie McGuire movie into a queer horror podcast. And then delights in it.
Lizzie McGuire, that movie and show are super queer, and her brother is totally gay. Probably not, actually. But,
ouch.
Yeah. So we have yet another connection to Lizzie McGuire in one of our movies.
I refuse to acknowledge. No. Yeah, so she is chasing this boy around. He is obviously obsessed with, like, a particular frame of time. So in this case, we just think that it's, oh, this horse is going to be dissected at a particular time. But we'll learn later that his trauma is actually also associated with a particular time frame. And he disappears. This is where we go down in some herky-jerky transitions, which were very of the time. Once again, any of this camera motion gives me very, like, House on Haunted Hill, Dark Castle vein.
Okay. I was thinking got so excited. I was like, oh, this is very much like Castle Haunted Hill, which came out the year before. Mm-hmm. When we get to the cells, it's very much like 13 Ghosts is what I was thinking. But then I went and watched the fucking music videos that inspired him. And specifically, it's the Nine Inch Nails one, Closer, which features a lot of this. Although Marilyn Manson's Tourniquet also has like the doll figures that you see in all of this. But yeah, it's, this is all a lot. I love the look of all this. It does feel very Dark Castle-y, and that this was in, like, a mainstream, I mean, again, I'm calling it a horror film, but this was marketed towards, like,
it's a sci-fi, yeah.
Yeah, like, we don't like the term elevated horror, it's a bullshit term, but if this was coming out today, it would probably be marketed as elevated horror, like something like that. Something you would see from an A24 release.
Yeah.
Even though it's, I think, more accessible than that.
Wow, so dismissive of A24.
No, I love A24, but again, you can show a Joe Blow this movie and they'll probably like be into it. Whereas, you know, I'm not going to show a Joe Blow The Witch without being like, hey, so this is the type of movie we're about to watch, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think people... We don't need to talk about A24 movies, but I do remember at the time when the reviews came out, that was one of the criticisms, though, was that it was very stylish, but also that it was kind of like, it's trying so hard to be intellectual because it's going into people's minds and it's, you know, it really wants to unpack things like Freudian and Lacanian imagery and stages of development. And you're like... sure, but it's also about a woman who just goes into a serial killer's brain and has, like, a bunch of adventures.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of... I don't think this movie has designs to make any grand statements about the human mind. I think... I mean, again, there is some stuff that's surface level. There's some stuff that digs a little bit deeper. But, I mean, at the end of the day, like, this is just more of a kind of a pulpy, fun movie for me that is, for the most part, fast-paced and just a feast for the eyes. But I don't necessarily feel intellectually stimulated watching it.
What's interesting is when you start to look at reviews of this film, like, from more academically inclined critics, the place that they go is actually how identity becomes represented through costume. So that's really, like, where the bulk load of the work on this film has been done. It's not actually about, like... Like, there's a little bit about Carl as, like, maybe a queer or, like, a sexually coded villain. But a lot of it is, like, how do the costumes in this film represent who the characters are and, like, the way that they evolve.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Okay, so we are back in this, like, automated showroom where we see representations of all the murders that Carl has committed. It's fantastic. Like, visually, it's great.
I wanted more of this. Like, I wanted, like, two more scenes of this at minimum. And that's, like, when the gate opens and, like, the bodybuilder woman comes out and grabs her. Like, that to me was, like, 13 Ghosts. But again, it's silly because 13 Ghosts came out the year after this.
Right, yeah.
So maybe 13 Ghosts took it from this.
Maybe this is just where we're at, yeah. Okay, so Strong Woman is here. She more or less knocks Catherine out, toot sweet, and delivers her to Carl's throne room.
This is also when we get, like, the kick in of Howard Shore's score when the woman's coming after her right before she knocks her out, and it's like, boom, boom,
yeah,
boom.
I would argue that this is among the scariest of the sequences in the film. Like, I know a lot of people talk about Vince Vaughn's torture. I don't necessarily find that scary. I find these opening parts where we really don't have a sense of the world that we're in. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's a huge sense of uncertainty. To me, that's where the scares come from.
Again, yeah, this sequence feels the most Nightmare on Elm Street to me. Vince Vaughn's torture feels like a prelude to the torture porn era we were going to get 5 years later when Hostel came out. Or I guess 4 years later when Saw came out.
Yeah.
I like that scene.
Sure.
But, it's not scary, it's just gross.
Exactly. Because really, it's like we're too busy focusing on his face as he's, like, screaming. And you're like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, they have some fun work with the sound design, but ultimately, yeah, this scene of her being stalked, looking at all the different victims, as you just see this behemoth woman stalking her down this hall, it is a delightful scene. It might be one of my favorites in the film.
Yeah. So she gets delivered to King Starger. So this is how we're going to distinguish between his young self that Catherine is chasing throughout most of the film, and then this kind of embodiment of everything that human Carl envisions himself to be, which is like this king who is all powerful. I love the fact that he's coded as like kind of gender fluid in a lot of the costuming, really exquisite makeup.
He wears gowns a lot.
Yeah.
Like very like regal gowns. I don't know if there's any cultural significance, because I know towards the end we get the kind of Japanese cherry blossom snow thing, so yep. I don't know if there's anything with his outfits that are meant to be of a different culture, but yeah, it's not quite dresses that he's wearing, but it's just these really wonderful gowns.
Yeah, so they're often drawn from real life figures, and apparently it was like people who were in positions of like power and authority, and I think part of it is like Japanese and part of it is African.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Because really, it's like, when you think of where they shot and who the costume designer was. But yeah, so the whole idea is that Carl, this is how Carl really envisions himself. Like, this is his ultimate form. If he was given all of the power and the ability to do what he wanted. So Catherine rightfully freaks out and she's back in the real world. So that's the end of round one in this film.
And 8-minute sequence, by the way.
That is crazy. It feels like 20.
No, it feels a lot longer because it's such a good introduction to this world, because as an audience member, you're watching this, what am I going to see here? Like, the whole allure of the film was, like, enter the mind of a killer. Like, that's what you're doing. And it's just like, what am I going to see? I would argue that it could have gone even more depraved if they really wanted to dip more into horror stuff, but because this is, like, a high-profile, more high-concept release, it's not going to do that, but... It's still plenty nasty what we see.
And don't forget that even though this is the year 2000, at this point in horror, we were very much in the middle of the second cycle of slasher films. So a movie about adults wasn't going to make a lot of money, or it wasn't like considered what horror was doing at the time. So I think they were deliberately not going after the horror crowd, because this isn't what horror wanted to see.
Well, it's also about a year and a half after Columbine, so I think that like leaning heavily into the violence isn't something that the studio was going to want to do anyway.
Right, yeah. Columbine.
Yeah.
Okay, so back in the real world, we get a little bit of exposition. Basically, Dylan Baker's role in this movie is to tell us things that we need to know about the subconscious. And
which, again, though, why do you have him and Marianne Jean Baptiste? Like, why don't you just have one person do this role? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we just needed to give all these people work in the year 2000. So we get this annoying thing where it's like, oh, well, if your body tricks you into convincing that it's real, then you could die when you go into this. So it's, you know, it's helpful because it sets the stakes, but sure, it's nothing that we haven't heard before.
Nightmare on Elm Street, baby.
You betcha. So this is the part that I kind of tuned out. It's
okay.
More or less, it's Peter and Catherine bonding while he's also subtly manipulating her into saying like, okay, I know you had a bad experience, but you also have to go back in.
Okay, well, in case you missed what he said...
No, I missed nothing. I told you.
Basically, he's so intent on catching this killer, because there was a little girl that... So he would work for the DA's office, and there was a little girl who was molested. The molester got off because of... Shut up! The molester got off because of, like, fucked up evidence. The night he was released, the girl's parents, I guess, left her at home, because that's what you do.
As you do.
And yep. They got back, and the molester was, like, at their house, sitting on the couch with their little girl. He had split her open, emptied her out, left her heart in the freezer because he thought they might want to keep it. And so ever since then, he said, fuck the law system, I'm going to become an FBI agent and catch them myself. That's your three-dimensional character development for Mr. Novak, Vince Vaughn.
So as I said, I missed nothing. Where does that come back into play, apart from the fact that he's a super diligent FBI agent?
It's character development. It's supposed to, okay, oh God. Had we gotten the original thing for Catherine with the abortion, which we'll talk about in a bit, it would have probably been more of a, they would have played a part into like connecting the two characters, but we don't get that. So it does seem a bit like, oh God, why are we spending time talking about this? Why do we care?
Yeah. Because this scene is also 20 minutes long, is it not?
No, it's not.
Look, I'm just really excited to talk about abortions out of the sides of our mouth when we get there.
Yes.
Like, whoa.
Abortion.
Yeah. So all this to say, she is convinced. Yes, she will give it a second try. So she goes in for round number two. I do like this fake out, just... if only because at this point we think we know what to expect, so it's a nice subversion where she tries to go in, and then she thinks it hasn't worked, and then she's like, little J-Lo in the corner.
See, though, it is, but again, and I will admit I've never seen Dreamscape, so I can't comment if it happens in that movie, but this is a trope that all those Nightmare on Elm Street movies use, where it's like, oops, we're in a dream, I didn't realize that, mm-hmm. So... I like it, but it's not original.
But don't you like how it immediately plays out? You know, where she looks over and she's like, oh, shit, I'm already here. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not really a change in visual. Is there to signify that she's in the world? Yeah, that is very good.
Yeah, and I think it's, if you want to think about it this way, it's already telling you that she's lost because she can't tell reality from... the dream, because she's right. Like, oh shit, I'm already here. Oh wait, so we're gonna have trouble in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she then finds herself in a glass cage. It's revealed to be upside down. She seems to fall. It goes into slow motion. Fucking gorgeous. Like, I'm sorry, it's just, it's so hard to talk about this film and not be like, it's so gorgeous, it's so striking, it's so crazy. Like, it's bubblegum mm-hmm. for the eyes, this movie.
A lot of this, too, the music video that this is kind of looking at is Madonna's Bedtime Story. I also forgot to mention that all these music videos that we're talking about, with the exception of the Manson ones, they're directed by Mark Romanek.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know who that is, but he's a major music video director, did a lot of Nine Inch Nails, obviously, but he's also, his only feature film credit is One Hour Photo.
Ooh. Potential stay tuned, because I feel like we could easily talk about that movie.
Oh, yes.
I actually quite like it. Like, I know a lot mm-hmm. of people do not like the dark Robin Williams triptych, but...
no, I like it. Give me that. Give me Insomnia. I'm all for it.
Yeah, and then the final one is... Is it Death to Smoochie that he's in as well?
I love Death to Smoochie. Yes. No one else likes it, but I love it.
Not a lot. I would argue that's the least popular of the three. The other two, at least people will get on board for.
Death to Smoochie has like the Drop Dead Gorgeous thing where it's like, okay, if you watch it now, it's really funny. But like, I think at the time, people just weren't ready for the type of humor it was doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People don't like a dark comedy ever.
No.
What? You can't make me feel bad and ask me to laugh at it. I'm not doing that.
100%.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, we get some fun imagery here. She ultimately winds up in Carl's childhood home, where she helps him do some dishes. This is where the clock comes back into play. She gets locked into the closet, and then she watches the sort of unseen father figure. So, like, we don't really get a good look at him, and I think that's also important. Like, he's almost his own mirage that Carl can't face, and Carl gets beaten for playing with toys, and it's actually quite uncomfortable to watch.
Apparently this was trying to emulate David Lynch's Blue Velvet.
Okay.
Oh my god, very different.
Wrong David.
but this is where we get the line, and again, like, it wouldn't really raise any eyebrows for people, I think, but I think as a queer viewer, like, this is when he tells him, I didn't raise no faggot, and he proceeds to beat his son, take him to his room, say, oh, these dolls are everywhere, you're some kind of sissy.
Yeah.
And then I get, there was an iron in there, so yeah, then he, like, I mean, we don't see it, but, like, we know that he, like, burns him with this iron.
Definitely hear it, yeah.
Again, this is one that, like, I mean, again, I wasn't abused when I was a kid, so I can't speak from that perspective, but just being like, oh, like, this is something that our community goes through a lot, like, as we age as children, like, some people do get abused because they are queer, be it from their parents, or be it from bullies at school, or be it from strangers on the side of the road. And I say it happens to kids, it happens to adults.
Yep.
So whether or not you want to read Carl as queer, nevertheless, the implication of the scene is that his father thinks that he might be queer.
Yeah.
And he's abusing him just for that reason. And so me watching that, it was like, ugh, like it definitely struck a chord with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This isn't unconventional. Like, I think we're pretty used to seeing this kind of trauma inflicted on people, but it still hurts. And the implication being that even if he wasn't, he's being punished for the presumption of being gay is like, yeah, this is very real and it's very hard.
Unfortunately, yeah, it doesn't really amount to much later because we don't really come back to whatever that was. I mean, the long and short of it is he was abused by his dad and that's why he's a killer. Like,
a little bit, yeah. It's pretty much like this equals this.
Pretty much. And again, like, there's criticism to be had there, and I totally get that, but the movie's not interested in addressing that, so.
No. Okay, so she ends up turning around in the closet. This is where we see adult, like, regular adult Carl washing a corpse in the bathtub, and we get a little bit of his kind of backstory, where he talks about the fact that he had a seizure during his baptism at age 6, so that's the origin of the trauma that Dr. Reed was talking about earlier, so hence the water as the big motif.
And this is also a reference to a music video, this time one of Sing's own. It's R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion. The setting for this is very much like the one room setting of that music video.
Yeah, and there's like religious potential abuse situations heavily coded in that song as well.
100%. I mean, yeah, it's about losing my religion.
It's so funny because for some reason when I was a kid, I stupidly assumed that like religion was a coded word for sex. So I was like, oh, it's about losing your virginity. And then it's like, when you see the video, no.
No. But again, with song lyrics, much like film, you can read it any way. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, yeah, the video takes a certain approach. It's interesting, right? Music videos are one particular reading of a song's lyrics, but you can also, if you don't watch the video, you can read it any way. So it could be what you're reading, just not in the video.
Yeah. Which, again, I think it's why it's so fascinating that this film is driven by music videos. Like, it makes sense because it's Sing's background, but it's also, like, because this was the heyday of a certain kind of visual medium, it naturally makes sense that it would then flow into narrative features. But I don't know of many other feature films that have been so heavily influenced by, like, these iconic music videos. Like, it just kind of reinforces to me that the music video is a bit of a lost art now. And like, there was a period of time where we were deriving really deep, meaningful pop cultural moments from those videos.
Yeah. 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 And we it doesn't happen as much anymore, unless you're something who is like, I'm going to say auteur, yeah, like Beyonce, or yeah, even Lady Gaga. Like, when you hear, like, I mean, Taylor Swift has music videos, even if you want to go into pop, but, like, it's not like that. Yeah. Although, I actually think Mark Romanek did the Shake It Off music video.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, like, I think the difference is that now, when you do see an artist make a music video, it becomes a kind of sensational event. Like, oh, mm-hmm. this person has deemed it worthwhile to sink millions of dollars into this iconic production.
Yeah.
But it tends to only be the biggest of names, right? Like, you're not going to have an REM equivalent in 2020 make a music video because it's too expensive. Who's going to watch it? Who cares?
Exactly.
So this is an interesting bonding moment between Catherine and regular adult Carl, but mm-hmm. it doesn't last long. So this is where we get the return of King Starker. He goes backwards into the shadows in the corner of the room, and when he comes back out, he is King Starker. He's got these really gorgeous hair horns.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to try to style my hair that way for this video, but you know, I just didn't think I could pull it off.
And again, this is kind of where I'm going into queerness for him, because he's very much like a male realistic Maleficent. So, yeah, I mean, you can read that however you want, but yeah. Sure. But again, I don't know if I want to read him as queer, because he's a terrible fucking human being.
I like that there's a sense of almost pomp and circumstance to his most desirable goal. Like, if you can remove the fact that he is obviously a terrible person who murders women and then masturbates over their corpses... he's a bit of a diva.
Yeah. But again, though, that's, I mean, in some of our previous episodes, we've discussed the implication of, like, the queer villain, the queer monster.
Yeah.
And how sometimes it's okay. Like, I like identifying with the villain sometimes, but it's always the issue of, like, okay, well, are they a villain, though, because they're queer, or are they a villain that happens to be queer? And unfortunately, in this case, it's kind of like an offshoot. Like, he is, let's say he's queer. But he's a villain because of the abuse he suffered because he was queer. So there's like an extra step there.
Yeah. It's like a little minor detour roadblock kind of thing. Yeah. So at this point, he gets the jump on Catherine and he really surprises her. He scares her. He ends up getting this kind of necklace vice thing around her neck. And at this point, she is lost.
But that's also a symbol, because that's what he puts on the victims after he gets rid of their bodies earlier in the film.
Yeah, there is a lot of, like, speaking to reality if you're paying attention to, like, his particular motions and symbols and stuff.
Right.
So we briefly cut back to the real world. Every once in a while, we'll get a shot of Julia in her dumb cage being like, ooh, and she gets wet. And you're like, okay, cool. I know you're still...
Tarzan's like, you can't swim. Cut you out.
The scene would have been 5 minutes, but you only get 2 because you can't fucking swim.
So make it work, bitch.
Yeah. So, of course, we have to have big, strong Vince Vaughn come in to save little Jennifer Lopez, because we're basically still in the 90s. And he, with no training at all, with zero preparedness to take this on, he jacks in. And
so...
I don't like it.
I don't... Whatever about his character having no experience. It makes no fucking sense.
No.
But B, this is very much like, okay, our lead actress, our lead character, who's female, now needs rescuing by a big, strong man.
Correct.
I would have preferred it if it was Marianne Jean Baptiste going in after her.
Yes. Like, and I honestly believe that if this film was made nowadays, if we still had Dylan Baker and Marianne Jean Baptiste, I do think that it would be like, okay, Marianne, you go in.
Well, because that's a reason to have 2 of them, right? So one of them can stay out in case one of them needs to go in, which I think may be the reason why there is 2 of them. But yeah, it doesn't make any sense for them to send in Vince Vaughn.
No.
Other than the studio was like, no, we need a white man to go in and save the woman of color. But today, yeah, we could have 2 women of color ruling the mind of the killer.
Yeah.
And we don't get that here.
No. Yeah, it's definitely the thing to me that is, like, the most 2000s about this. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, can we please send in the white male to save the fucking day? And that's not doing the film... That's maybe being a little unfair, considering Jennifer Lopez does save herself in the end.
Right.
But here she needs saving.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he goes in. We get some more iconic music video imagery. So he shows up in trenches, and there's like 3 identical women who have a kind of like weird poetry moment with him.
That's a rare instance, too. I mean, obviously, he's used the work of H.R. Giger to, like, do some of the set design. This is a reference to a painting called Dawn by Norwegian painter Odd Nerdrum.
Again, it's really visually striking. Does it need to be in here? Maybe not. Maybe not. So he ends up getting lured into kind of like the magic room. It's basically just a giant open room, like a circular room that has a bed in the middle. Jennifer Lopez is here, and Catherine has been made up in like Carl's sex fantasy. So
I love all of this.
Like, it is a good look.
Like the red like neck brace she has on, mm-hmm. like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, so again, this is the kind of semi-sadomasochistic sex play lingerie mm-hmm. that we've been seeing. And of course, there's the famous anecdote that comes up whenever you talk about this particular scene, which is that Jennifer Lopez was like, hey, can you loosen this collar? And the answer was no, because it's supposed to hurt. Like, you're supposed to be you're supposed to be tortured. So it was very much like, if you were going to wear these costumes, you had to go all in.
We do, oh, well, not yet, but so, okay, so he comes up and he, like, you know, puts a bag over his head.
Yeah,
then we get this intestine thing. Yeah.
Yep.
Then we get this intestine scene. As gross as this is, I do think the constant cutaways to her mm-hmm. doing her smile, like, it's so creepy. It is so creepy. And she's like, it's acting, but like, it's just the fucking face she's making.
Acting!
And she's so good!
Yeah, and I think the people who dismiss Jennifer Lopez in this role aren't paying attention to the differences, like the levels of her performance, because mm-hmm. this is most emphatically not the Catherine that we have seen. And she has no dialogue in this part.
No.
Like, it is just her in anticipation watching this horrific scene unfold and like getting presumably sexual pleasure out of this.
Yes. It's more implied, though, right? Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, this is one of the few moments in the film where, yeah, the sexuality is really downplayed. Except, whatever performance D'Onofrio is giving here, it's so like, good. It reminded me of, like, Alice in Wonderland, almost, where it's like a Tweedledee or Tweedledum. But, yeah, so then we get the great shot of the scissors going in. Mm-hmm. He, like, digs around, and boom, out comes that intestine.
Yeah, and then he plays it like a music box.
Oh, it's so good. And he's doing those...
Yeah. So throughout all of this, this is actually, I think, also where the film makes really good use of its sound design. So mm-hmm. I've been telling you, Trace, that ever since I moved the furniture around in my apartment, my TV is very far away from the couch. And sometimes I'm like, I need subtitles. I can't hear what's happening. And I definitely cranked the volume at this part because I was like, I can't even hear what Vince Vaughn is saying. Like, what is he yelling at her, trying to get her to wake up? And then I realized, oh, it's actually because they've muted the sound design because we're supposed to be back in Catherine's point of view.
Right.
And he's breaking into, like, breaking through the barriers that Carl Kingstarker yeah. has put up. And it's only when she starts to hear him because he connects with her that we get the sound back at full volume.
The way he connects with her is by regaling a tale. Because before he goes in, Mary and Jean Baptiste is like, you've read her file, you know her, to say something personal. Yeah. Okay, well, it would really make
more
sense.
They know each other so well after the 2 hours.
So... he's like, oh, your brother got in a car crash and had a coma and he died. Like, that's apparently why she's so obsessed with comas.
Right.
The original idea for this scene. So he was supposed to remind Catherine that she had an abortion in college. And her resulting guilt and regret led her to becoming a child psychologist. There are two versions as to why this didn't go through. So one is that test audiences didn't like this scene because it arguably made Catherine less sympathetic as a protagonist because she willingly went through an abortion.
I'm sorry, but that is the most American fucking response I've ever heard, and you guys are dumb.
Singh in the commentary says, he goes, and I quote, nobody would let me do it, so he shot it anyway and had him screen it. He, and I'm guessing this is maybe the head of New Line, he really fought me on it, but after he did, he loved it. But too many folks in power were offended by it, so they changed it. So it's either test audiences didn't like it, or the studio heads didn't like it, or maybe it was both.
Right.
I just think it's so funny that it's like, oh, your entire, like, your protagonist can be deemed unlikable simply by the fact that she had an abortion in college. It's so fucked up.
Yeah.
And... I actually would have. So you mentioned that you thought it might have been a bad idea to include. Is it too on the nose for you? She had an abortion, so she really likes kids now?
I just don't think the connection is as strong as giving her a familial piece, right? Like, because the whole thing is that she is young and inexperienced, but there's something about her. Like, Dylan Baker literally says she's got something that the other people that we tried to do this program with don't have. So I think it makes sense to root that in a sense of shared trauma, because this movie is all about trauma. So I don't know that would have come through quite as clearly if you just said, oh, it's because she had an abortion, so she... Because it's like, what? Having an abortion doesn't make you love kids. It doesn't make you unable to have kids most of the time. So I just don't think the connections are strong.
I do agree, but of course, both of us as men, neither one of us are capable of having an abortion, and we have not had an abortion. So we can't really know the emotional toll that it would take on a woman. And, like, what it would, how it would inform her later life. But that being said, I mean, it can affect you in a variety of different ways, like any kind of traumatic incident could.
Yeah, fair. And I'm going to briefly put the little asterisk at the top, which is to say that some men can have pregnancies and can't give birth. So.
Oh, right. Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's one of those things that we're constantly renegotiating because we live in a great world where all of that shit can now happen. Yay. Mm-hmm. But it also is like trying to counteract years of ingrained bullshit that society has fed us.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So all this to say, Catherine's backstory does not come into play here. It is her brother. So she breaks the spell and she and Peter end up running away. And they encounter young Carl. They discover a kind of visual signifier. I still don't really understand how this helps them to understand where Julia is being kept.
I didn't either. And the visuals here are back to Madonna's bedtime story, because there's the weird cube things. He sees a symbol.
Yeah.
And that makes him connect it to something. I don't really know.
Yeah, so the symbol is replicated from the table that he lays the bodies on in his basement. So I guess seeing that in this dream unconscious world is enough to cue him to say, oh, okay, that's the important piece because it's showing up here. That means it's important in the real world. So that's what cues him to say, we need to do the history on where this symbol comes from.
But then we get this like weird accordion version of King Starger.
Love it! Yeah, so this was apparently D'Onofrio. Like, he came up with these movements. And it's interesting because apparently Singh talks about this film as an opera a lot. Mm-hmm. And he very much references like what D'Onofrio brings to the table, particularly in this scene, is that sense of the operatic.
Yeah, and I think that's also because one of the complaints about the film was that it wasn't very subtle. There was no nuance, and he used the opera excuse as a way to be like, well, operas aren't subtle. Like, operas are loud, and they're very animated and cartoonish. That's what this movie is. Maybe the issue is that because of what the subject matter is, people had an issue with that.
Right.
But maybe because we're genre fans, like, it works for us. I don't know.
Yeah. I also just, I don't agree. I think that there's lots of subtlety in this film, but there's also a lot of things that are very on the surface. Mm-hmm. And typically, if you're thinking about films that don't do well with test audiences, it's films that are, like, if you're not straightforward enough, your test audience will be like, I don't get it. It's confusing. So, like, the fact that a criticism is that it was...
Yeah.
I'm like, come on, people. Like, you can't have it both ways. You can't want it to be subtle, but also then say, oh, it also needs to be on the nose. Like, come on.
Exactly.
So they've got what they needed, and young Carl gets abducted by King Starger, and Catherine is very upset, and Vince Vaughn is like, who fucking cares? We got what we needed, manpower! So they're back in the railroad. Okay, so at this point, this is where Julia's cell begins to fill with water, so the time is up. They need to get to her before she drowns. So they send Peter off on his cop adventure. He flies off in a helicopter. He contacts Dean Norris and they track the thing and they go. And who could fucking care?
But this also feels very silenced. Like, this is when the score kicks in, when it's like a slow motion helicopter and it's like, boom.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because we're desperately meant to care about this woman we know nothing about from this character that we also don't really know much about, who really wants to get to her in time. Oh my gosh. And all the rest of us are just like, hi, can we go back to Catherine?
Which they do,
thankfully.
But it is intercut, like her rescuing slash murdering young Starger is intercut with the scenes of them rescuing the Julia Hickson. Yeah. That is her name.
That is her name, correct. She of the lifeguard who can't swim.
The lifeguard.
Yeah, and of course the visual imagery is meant to parallel each other. Like, they're on similar journeys to rescue these people. So Catherine has to save young Carl, and Peter has to save the lifeguard.
Yeah.
Which makes it sound like an aborted season of, like, heroes. Save the lifeguard! Save the world! okay, so at this point, Catherine decides that she's going to reverse the feed, which is what she had suggested doing with Edward. So she locks out Dylan Baker, she locks out Marianne Jean-Baptiste, and she goes back in for another round, only this time Carl is going to come into her world. And
which they've primed us for, because they've the whole beginning, they didn't want Edward to come into her mind, and blah, 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 blah. It's dangerous, whatever.
Yeah, which we're just kind of meant to say, yes, okay, we will go along with that. So we cut to this final kind of, what do we call it, a tableau in a way. So she is now outfitted as a Mother Teresa nun. And it's important to note that the color scheme has been reversed. So whenever Carl's in control, it's a lot of reds, whereas here it's a lot of like whites and blues. So like
blues and pinks.
Yeah. So softer colors, and they're meant to convey that, like, oh, okay, Catherine is in control, and also she is a calming figure. So that's why she's trying to connect with young Carl in this situation.
Right.
And that works for a little bit.
I do love the setting, though. I mean, it reminds me of, I don't know if you've seen the movie Kwaidon from like the 60s. It's like a Japanese anthology film, but there's a whole setting of the snow. So it's just like this with cherry blossoms, basically.
Yeah. Isn't it bad that, like, as dumb North Americans, we're basically like, oh, a bit of snow and cherry blossoms. It's very Japanese.
Mean, well, okay, no, I looked this up because I was like, I think it's a little interesting that her mind, who's, I think Jennifer Lopez is Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
That her, the inside of her mind is a Japanese setting. But cherry blossoms are, like, the official flower of Japan, and they're primarily seen in, like, Taiwan, Japan, like, those areas.
Okay.
So I found it interesting that the inside of her mind was essentially like a snowy Japan.
Oh my god, who knew that 2000s level J-Lo was like culturally appropriate? I think if nothing else, this to me speaks to how much of a collaborative effort it was between the costuming and then some of the visual signifiers that Tarsen Singh ended up coming to.
I mean, because the costumer was, I mean, I don't know the exact Asian descent, but it was a person of Asian descent.
Yeah, so she connects with young Carl. We get some really interesting visual, like, vines creeping around the edges, which to me has always suggested that, like, she's making contact and it's working. Like, it's almost flowery and romantic and, like, the end of a Disney movie.
The visual also is taken right out of his Losing My Religion video. Like, there it is, like, okay. Yeah, there's like a whole shot of someone with this gold vine thing. But of course, in the music video, it's impractical. In this, it is CGI.
Yeah, and I would argue that it looks okay. It didn't, you know, it looks fake, but I feel like it's fake in a way that reinforces what he's trying to achieve. You know, compare this to the weird rainbow xyloscope kind of look of when Vince Vaughn goes into
the world.
And I was like, holy fucking late 90s CGI. Oh my God.
No. The entering of the mind for J-Lo, for the first time she goes in, that looks mostly okay. The Vince Vaughn one is like 30 seconds long.
It's so too long.
A bunch of needless CGI. I can't believe we didn't comment on that. That looks bad.
it definitely reminded me of that late 90s propensity to imagine that the future was always going to be VR in simulations, and you get stuff like Hackers and Johnny Mnemonic, where the entering into a virtual reality simulation is basically just like, oh, okay, we shit out a colored tube and like spun a camera around in it for 30 seconds.
Right.
It's not a good look. It has not aged well, we'll put it that way.
I don't think it looked good in 2000. It definitely does not look good in 2020.
No. Okay, so this is working. We've got these beautiful vines. It's almost romantic. It's very, like, it's warm, right? And then the vines start to retreat, and you're like, ah, shit, here we go. So this is when young Carl says, he's here, and the pool becomes King Starger's head and cape.
It's really, really cool.
Oh, man. And he looks like somewhere between like a reptilian and a god. It's, I mean, mm-hmm. goddamn, this movie with its visuals. Just A+. Well,
yeah, it appears and yeah, he just comes out with just that cape. Just mm-hmm. I mean, again, I love a cape.
Love a cape.
We're good.
Again, diva worship, give me a cape. Yeah.
Diva!
Okay, so at this point, it's interesting because I've seen people suggest that with the arrival of Kingstarter, he takes control because it's like, we see the bugs that appear on young Carl. But I would, like, people have read J-Lo's final costume change into the warrior as something that he does, like he turns her into this, and I never saw it that way.
No,
this is her activating like full bitch mode.
Well, I because I think he takes control when he comes out, but yeah. then her changing costume is her taking control back.
Yeah, yeah, like that's what 100% I always took it. Yeah,
yeah.
I was like,
those people are wrong.
Okay, good. I was like, am I crazy? Am I
no
bananas?
And it's, I love this warrior transformation for her. I think yeah. it looks fantastic.
Again, looks great. Yeah.
And it's just really fun. I think that the death scene goes on a little bit too long.
I actually could have done with more of this, like, battle stuff. Like, I appreciate that he doesn't want to turn it into an action film. Like, there was talk about, like, some of the action sequences being longer and more bombastic, and I think he really fought against that.
But see, okay, but imagine, like, again, I mean, maybe this would make it worse, but, like, we have this Japanese, we assume, setting.
Right.
If we get kind of, like, a pseudo-samurai battle with, like, okay. she has a sword.
Yes.
Like, something like the Kill Bill Volume 1, The Bride and Oren Ishii, like, something like that. I mean, but you know, more violent,
right?
Like, oh, that would have been cool. I think, I mean, but I can see why he wanted to avoid that.
Sure. Yeah. Did you appreciate that she crucifies him with her arrows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure did.
Just to make sure that everybody understands we're still dealing with some of that religious guilt.
A lot of religious shit there. So okay, I want to bring the abortion back though, because the way that resolves this, well, no, she has to kill this child. Mm-hmm. She has to drown the young Starger to set him free and kill him.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
If we have an abortion in her backstory, she is now forced to kill another child. And I think that's more thematically relevant, and it's actually more beautiful or poignant, right. if you will, for her character.
What's interesting is that I don't think people see that, like, people see this as an act of mercy.
Mm-hmm.
So to conflate that with an abortion is like, I can't help but also wonder if that's maybe where some of the less than positive feedback he was receiving from either test audiences or higher ups came from.
It's entirely possible. And of course, we're not going to get into pro-life, pro-choice debate here, because I mean, it just all depends on how you view the fetus that she would have aborted. But be it like a living child, whatever, we're not going to get into it.
Yeah, I was going to say, no, there's no debate because it's a woman's choice. It's always a woman's choice. And fuck you if you think you have designs on somebody else's body.
Oh, no, I just think that we're not going to talk about this.
Oh, because I see. I just okay. Like,
yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, I agree with you, but we're not going to talk about it.
Okay.
I do get it, but yeah, I still just kind of think it would have been a bit more poetic. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, now that we've talked it through, I'm inclined to agree with you, but I can see why they maybe made the less controversial choice.
But she clearly regretted having, let's say she had the abortion, she regretted having the abortion. She also doesn't want to kill this child. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's not killing him because he doesn't exist. But, oh, that's kind of also another thing, right? Where it's like, oh, the kid doesn't exist, mm-hmm. but then does the kid for the abortion really exist? Blah, 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 blah. I know.
Come back to me.
I'm like going on this tailspin of like, oh, I'm just realizing all this. But I think it would have been like another thing where she's like, okay, I don't want to do this, but I have to as a necessary evil of sorts.
Yeah, and in this case, it's because, of course, the two are linked, so the child that he was and the villain that he has become. And what's interesting, too, is, like, we never see adult Carl in his regular form. Like, we see him for that one brief moment by the bathtub, and that's the only instance we see of him in this entire dream world. So you're either, he's one or the other in this case.
Right.
And to get rid of one, you have to kill the other. So that's what she does. She drowns young Carl, thereby putting him to rest. And at the same time, we see Peter rescuing Julia, and he's reassuring her, and she's holding onto him like a child would, because she's a lifeguard who can't swim.
You're a lifeguard who can't swim.
That's way harsh, Catherine. And this is, I basically, like, my notes just end here. I know that there is a coda where she adopts the fucking dog and she goes to see Peter, and I'm just so glad that they don't kiss.
They, oh yeah, that's terrible. Also, they would not let her keep that dog.
Absolutely not. No.
I don't think that's a thing. Yeah, they have that whole line where it's like, oh, because she shows up at the site and they're like, oh, that's kind of strange. And she's like, she's keeping the dog, man. I'd say strange is par for the course. She's so weird. She's got glasses and a ponytail.
Oh my God. She's got a weird licorice blood suit that she uses to go into people's minds. She's weird.
They did add the coda, though, with her going back to Edward.
Oh, okay. I actually think that's smart. That does
yeah,
work.
Well, because they realized that they didn't have an ending for that. And so they were like, oh, we should probably do that.
we should maybe address the fact that she's also good at her actual job, not just killing serial killers.
Exactly. Well, that's the other thing too, right? She essentially commits murder. Like, like there's this whole thing where, yeah, like the FBI isn't officially recognizing the research. They're like, oh no, you gave Vince Vaughn hallucinatory drugs, which triggered his memory of where where Julia Hickson was. And you're like, okay.
I mean, but is that a detail we really needed to include in this?
No. I mean, I was just more like concerned with the fact that she did murder this guy. I mean, like, they can't prove it because, like, yeah.
Plausible deniability. I didn't do it.
I was asleep the whole time, officer.
I was on drugs.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it ends with that. And it's, I still, like, I mean, again, we've addressed a lot of this movie's flaws, but I still think that the its strengths far outweigh any of its shortcomings.
Yeah, I am inclined to agree. Now, I remember at the time, it was very much like, if this movie does well, do you think they'll make a sequel? Which, of course, they obviously never do.
No, they did make a sequel.
Wait, what?
There's a straight-to-DVD sequel called The Cell 2.
Wait, what? What?
It came out like in 07 or 08. I haven't seen it. By all accounts, it's terrible.
Oh, of course it's terrible.
It's not like a straight... It's an unrelated sequel.
Right.
But it is called The Cell 2.
Wow. I never knew. Because honestly, part of me was like, I could see them trying to do this again, but it would... Like, you couldn't bring in a new serial killer and a new ticking clock, because that would just be stupid.
But that's your procedural. Like, if this was a TV show, that's what it would be, right? It would be a new killer, a new mind every week.
Yes, and Holly Hunter and Sigourney Weaver would be the people that they would ask to consult. Oh my God, can you imagine that crossover, though?
That'd be really cool. And then Julia, because at this point, Jodie Foster's not doing it, so Julianne Moore would come in as Clarice Starling.
Right, yeah, yeah. Hi, Jodie, we'd really love you to come back and play Clarice. So, Jodie, I think we got disconnected. Can you just get me Julianne on the other line?
I'll do it. It's just a really, I want to say fun movie, but it's also like a fun movie about some really fucked up things. I really admire the artistry here. I think Singh is a great director. I do want to go watch The Fall now because I haven't seen it, but...
Yeah. It's great in terms of the visuals. Lee Pace is amazing. And, you know, I fucking love a tall gay man, so bring on that drink of water. But I think it's emotionally much more mature. So it just... You feel things when you watch it, even though it doesn't have a super strong narrative. Like, it's still a lot of kind of dream logic-y stuff. Like,
yeah.
But all that to say, if you like The Cell, The Fall is a good companion to it.
I mean, happy late 20th, The Cell. You hold up.
You hold up. Those visuals look fucking amazing to this day.
Agreed. So yeah, before we wrap this up, we just wanted to kind of thank Nightstream Film Festival again. We really appreciate y'all taking the time to, well, I mean, for inviting us. I mean, I'm sure there was time spent on us, but for letting us come and do this. And so, yeah, if you like us, please check us out. We've got our socials on @HorrorQueers on Twitter and Instagram. You can find the podcast either at bloodydisgusting.com/podcast or pretty much anywhere podcasts are found. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all that jazz.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, on that note, I think we can cross out The Cell.
Yes, and cross out Horror Queers.
You've made it to the end of another Bloody Disgusting podcast. Congratulations. If you like our programming, consider searching for other Bloody Disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, Nightmare on Film Street, and more.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.